Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the rise of nativism and nationalism in the UK following the brutal murder of Joe Cox, a Labour Member of Parliament, by an assassin who calls himself Death to Traitors, Freedom for Britain. This ahead of Thursday's vote on the so-called Brexit of the UK from the EU. Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly the BBC social affairs editor and associate editor of The Independent, joins us to discuss the similarities in the UK to the rise of anti-immigrant racism in the US that Donald Trump is stoking amongst angry white working class voters, and the neck-and-neck polls that indicate a slight lead for the Leave vote, although the widespread shock and revulsion over the killing of the rising star in the Labour Party may tip the scales for the Remain vote. Then we'll look into the growing signs that the Republican Party is heading for a crack-up, as more and more Republicans, alarmed by the down-ballot disaster that Donald Trump poses for Republican control of the Senate and now even the House, are calling for a rules change at the convention to ease Trump out of the race and replace him with a candidate like Paul Ryan, who could mitigate the electoral meltdown Republican congressmen and senators fear. Bruce Bartlett, a columnist for the Fiscal Times, who was a senior policy analyst in the Reagan White House, joins us to discuss whether his prediction a year ago in Politico that Trump's defeat will purge the GOP of the Tea Party still holds, as the Republican Party now appears to be trying to purge Trump. Then finally, we will speak with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Affairs and a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He joins us to discuss his new book, America's Continuing Misadventures in the Middle East, and his latest article at the National Interest, What America Keeps Getting Wrong in the Middle East. We'll investigate the many foreign policy blunders, as well as explore policy changes that could reverse the serial quagmires the U.S. both creates and mires itself in the Middle East. And joining us now from the UK is Polly Toynbee, who's a columnist for The Guardian. She was formerly BBC social affairs editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Polly Toynbee.
Hello.
And in the UK today, of course, there were services and remembrance of the Labour MP, Joe Cox, who was brutally murdered. And the murderer, in fact, appeared before magistrates on Saturday, refused to give his name except called himself Death to Traitors, Freedom for Britain. This is obviously a deranged individual, but how much is this new nationalism that's sort of emerging as a result of the Brexit vote? How would you describe it? It sort of appears to be kind of a political form of soccer hooliganism.
There has always been, just bubbling under the surface, small groups who appear under different names at different times of extreme racist neo-Nazi in different kind of formulations, not very many of them. And they're an irritant. They're expensive for the police to police their demonstrations, which tend to be met by others, sort of hope not hate, and other anti-racist groups. But it's been absolutely on the margins. What has changed during this whole referendum debate is that serious heavyweight politicians, some of them in the cabinet itself, have given credence to that sort of view of the world. They have dabbled in a kind of anti-migrant language that is completely inappropriate and hasn't been seen in this country since Enoch Powell, you know, back in the early 60s, and he was expelled from his party for it. This has been something quite new. When reputable politicians stoop so low, become demagogues in a way, then you can stir up a lot of this passion. I think in any, it's nothing special about Britain. I think in any country, there's an incipient, unpleasant, anti-foreigner nationalism waiting to erupt if it's given permission. And up until now, it has simply not been a part of the respectable political scene.
Well, most certainly, Donald Trump has given millions of Americans permission to be racist. It's under the cover of an attack on political correctness, which is a code to say that we need permission to be racist. And
Who then would you identify in the UK context? Would Boris Johnson be one of these irresponsible politicians?
Certainly Boris Johnson, and amazingly, the Justice Secretary himself, Michael Gove. Ian Duncan Smith, who's only just stood down from the Cabinet, but has been responsible for, well, enormous benefit cuts, but a very important part of the of government in charge of welfare. Chris Grayling, who's leader of the House, which is an important democratic role. All of these are on the leave side of the argument, and all of them have been uncomfortably close to the unofficial leave campaign, which is run by Nigel Farage of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which has always been much more avowedly anti-migrant, but only has one MP, and then one MP is not in agreement with his leader anyway. So up until now, they've been fairly minor, but they've been allowed to put out appalling cartoons, really racist, a disgusting poster that came out an hour before Joe Cox was murdered, showing a great stream of Syrian refugees on the move through Slovenia last year, saying breaking point, implying they were all arriving here. We've taken virtually no refugees. We've taken fewer than any country in Europe. And it was a very savage attack on refugees, really, which is extraordinary. But I think it has been, the shock has been that these cabinet ministers have not condemned this stuff. And when pushed on television interviews, they will say, well, that's not our official campaign. But they have allowed their campaign to benefit from this stuff.
But my understanding, though, is, and I don't know the extent to which you can take anything seriously from the person who murdered the MP, Jo Cox, but she was obviously campaigning in a Labour district. And is there a kind of coalition between sort of, because Donald Trump here in the United States is appealing to angry white working class people, and I'm wondering whether that's the coalition of Leave, angry white working class people and the sort of Tory, you know, bring back the empire types?
Yes, I think so. We want our country back. That's the slogan. Like making America great again. Some mythical idea that there was once a time, the implication being when we were all white, without quite saying it, there was once a time when everything was better. They never quite define what back means, but that's the hint. I think it is a white working class thing. It is the big divide that the pollsters say that mostly ABC1 social group are mostly for Remain and C2DE are mostly for Leave. Some of this is for good reason in that if migration has had an impact anywhere, it tends to be on certain particular white working class areas which are poorer, and where perhaps they've put more pressure on public services, on school places, on housing particularly. We have a very acute housing shortage. And so some of those people have genuine cause for resentment that the government has not done enough to say, right, we'll build the housing, we'll build the schools, we'll build the hospitals. But that's a pretty small part of it. Most of it is an idea, because the most passionate feelings are often in places where they've never seen a migrant. But it is white working class predominantly, and led, as in America by Trump, by an elite pretending they are anti-establishment, which is laughable, but they seem to get away with it.
So what does this say about Jeremy Corbyn? I mean, clearly in Cameron's case, he brought all this upon himself by this entirely self-inflicted wound that the Brexit is, and I think his fate is tied up with it. But on the other hand, Corbyn, he seems to be not exactly a profile in courage. He's trying to sit on the fence rather than educate his voters about this catastrophic move, which it apparently is. He's sort of trying to have it both ways. Is that right?
Well, slightly less so than at the beginning of the campaign. Certainly he has been a lifetime anti-European, as some people on the far left are, on the grounds that this is a businessman's capitalist club, and there are still groups of far leftists who are joining the Leave group. But I think as the campaign's gone on and the nature of it has become clear, it's become clear who would be in charge. Cameron and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, would have to stand down immediately if they lost the referendum. So the country would then be in the hands of this Leave faction, who are, you know, far right, really. Well, with some populist tiddies, they keep saying they'll put more money in the NHS. They will take the money from the that's saved from what we give Europe, not that there would be any, but they say so, and put it in the NHS, though they've been as responsible as anybody else for cutting the funds to the NHS. But they would be the people in charge. And I think for Jeremy Corbyn, and for any Labour waverers, it's just become clear that if you think Cameron and Osborne are bad, if you're Labour, what you're going to get instead would be infinitely worse. And you will have aroused all of this wrath and expectation and anger amongst white working class people who are Labour's traditional voters. And the real fear for Labour now is that they may never get those voters back. They may be gone forever, either to nowhere or to UKIP or other far-right groups. Will they come back to Labour, who they will see having betrayed them for supporting the EU and its migration policy?
So if the Leave vote, if according to the polls, and I guess the caveat would be that the polls got a lot of the big recent political changes, including Cameron's re-election, wrong, but that notwithstanding, it seems that there's a possibility of a very narrow victory for Leave, although we don't know what kind of backlash has resulted from the murder of the Labour MP. But that seems to be the worst of all possible worlds, isn't it? I mean, it's going to, as you just pointed out, it's going to destroy both Cameron and Osborne and perhaps Corbyn's political careers. And wouldn't it be undone in a few years? The young people who are pro-European, as they move into the political process, I don't see this thing lasting if it's a narrow victory for Leave. If it's a narrow victory for Remain, then, you know, all will be forgiven, I guess. But what's your reading on that?
Well, a lot would happen in between. It's hard to imagine how we would creep back to Europe and beg them to take us back in again, unless it was in some, you know, a new appalling global cataclysm of some kind or another, financial or whatever. It's hard to see that happening, or Europe being very pleased to go through the whole process again. The process of disentangling us is going to be very lengthy, very complicated, quite bitter. And my fear is that on the British side, there will be a lot of blame. Oh, look, Europe are doing other bad things to us now. They're giving us bad terms in revenge. And that there will be even more hostility stoked up between us and our neighbours, which is a truly, I mean, given the history of, you know, forever of warfare, it's very easy to stir enmity between us and the French, and us particularly, us and the Germans, us and anybody really. What for? Why? So that the idea that we could then turn around and say, we'd like to come back, please, seems to me very unlikely, except in some extreme scenario. Even though young people, as they get older, will be in more position of power. I mean, it's a very curious thing that the radicals, the revolutionaries, the anarchists are the old voters who want out. And that's the sort of radical position. The people who were supposed to be the ballast are now the unsettlers. And it's the young voters for the status quo, which upends usual politics.
Well, Barack Obama, President Obama, went over to the UK a month or so ago for that very reason, didn't he, to fire up the young people and to give them a sense of responsibility of how important it is for them to vote. Is there any indication of whether he was successful or not?
It was a terrific visit. He spoke, as ever, very eloquently, said extremely sensible things, didn't put a foot wrong. Of course, the other side said, how dare some foreigner be interfering with us? Boris Johnson was exceptionally rude, almost going as far as to reference the Birther movement by referring to his Kenyan ancestry and suggesting that as a result of that, he was naturally anti-British because he was remembering the Kenyan independence from colonialism, which was madness. I think he did all, Obama did all he possibly could, but in truth, it didn't shift the polls at all. Nothing happened either way. to his visit. Perhaps it was a little early in the campaign. Might be better if he were flying in, you know, this weekend. But he did all he could, and it didn't have much effect.
Well, just finally then, Polly Toynbee, given that the polls have been wrong in the past, is there any possibility of a surprise here that Remain will triumph, even though the polls indicate the Leave might squeak by?
I think there certainly is. It's absolutely on a knife edge. If you talk to the sort of leading sociological academics, they say 50-50. But just in the last day or so, the polls have been moving slightly more towards Remain. There are quite a lot of don't knows still. There is a lot of evidence a number of people will make up their minds at the last moment, some even in the polling booth itself. My hunch, and I haven't thought this before, is that by a vote or two, Remain will just about get it. That, referendums tend to swing towards the status quo in the last stages. And I think it's just possible that those who are hesitating will say, it sounds awfully risky, it sounds difficult, it sounds fractious and fraught. And they'll look at Boris Johnson and say, you know, charming chap, but really, Prime Minister? Because it probably would be him. And they may not much like Cameron. He's not very popular these days. But on the other hand, he kind of looks like a Prime Minister. And people have got used to him. So I think if I had to bet the mortgage on it, I'd say we will just remain.
Well, Polly Toynbee, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Polly Toynbee, who is a columnist for The Guardian. She was formerly BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. She joined us from London. And we're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into growing signs that the Republican Party is heading for a crack-up.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bruce Bartlett, who's a columnist for the Fiscal Times and also contributes a weekly post to the economics blog at the New York Times and was previously a columnist for Forbes magazine and Creators Syndicate. He served on the staffs of Congressman Ron Paul and Jack Kemp and Senator Roger Jepson, and as executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress and senior policy analyst in the Reagan White House and Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of 7 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Imposter, How George W. Bush Betrayed America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy, The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics, and The Way Forward. And his latest book is Benefit and Burden. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Bartlett.
Happy to be here.
And Bruce, a year ago in the Politico, you wrote an article saying, well, maybe the best medicine for the Republican Party is for Donald Trump to become the nominee of the Republican Party, and it would be such a catastrophe that it would take down the party, but would also allow the party to purge itself of the Tea Party wing. Now it appears that the GOP is trying to purge itself of Donald Trump himself.
That's right, but I think that it's much, much too late. The idea that Republicans can save themselves in some sense of, you know, keeping control of the Senate and the House and saving, you know, vulnerable Republicans down ticket by replacing their presidential nominee, their presumptive nominee, is just, you know, utterly preposterous for a number of reasons. For one thing, there's no obvious replacement for Trump, at least nobody who anybody thinks would do better at this point. Number two, it would be the most undemocratic, that is, small d democratic thing one can possibly imagine. You'd be effectively disenfranchising 13 million Republican voters, saying your vote didn't count for anything. You know, we're just going to ignore it. And Trump won legitimately. Nobody has accused him of cheating. And finally, do you really want Trump going on cable television every single day until the election, trashing the Republican Party, which he is very easily capable of doing and would have a very strong incentive to do? Hell, he might even use the money he was planning on running for his own campaign to attack the Republican Party. He might even endorse Hillary. Who knows what he might do in retaliation? So all this talk is simply beyond stupid. It's impossible.
Well, you could add to that, and it may sound like a bit of a Hollywood movie, but given that the state of Ohio, where the convention will be in Cleveland, is an open carry state, if they screw with Trump, his supporters are likely to show up there with assault rifles, aren't they?
Well, I prefer not to think about such things, but right. Certainly violence on the part of Trump supporters is not unimaginable. You know, perhaps we do. I mean, some of us anyway are old enough to remember the convention in the Democratic convention in Chicago in 1968, and we may well see something of that sort.
So, Bruce Bartlett, again, a columnist for the Fiscal Times, he served on the congressional staffs of Congressman Ron Paul and Jack Kemp and Senator Roger Jepson, Executive Director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress, Senior Policy Analyst in the Reagan White House, and Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department during the George H.W. administration. And his latest book is Benefit and Burden. Clearly, Bruce Bartlett, you are a Republican, and of course it makes an awful lot of sense to me to talk to a Republican about the fate of your party. I don't know that anybody from the Green Party or the Democratic Party would be particularly useful on this subject. How does it feel to you, though? I mean, just in general, there's been this long, slow eclipse of this so-called moderate Republican, as though it's become an endangered species. And then you've had this emergence of the Tea Party, who have in many ways become the tail that wags the dog, and you've got, as you mentioned, 13 million Americans have already voted for Trump, largely from that wing. Are there two universes out here, not just in the Republican Party, but in our media in general, that you have the sort of, the pundits, the representatives of the party that you see on TV on the one hand, and you've got this inchoate mass of angry white working class voters out there who are voting for Trump, and we don't quite know what they think, and we certainly don't ask them what they think. So we don't know what's really in store, do we?
Well, we do know what they think, and what they think is both stupid and crazy. See, what I think has happened or happened over the years is that when the Tea Party came onto the scene spontaneously, all of a sudden, the Republican intellectuals and the Republican establishment saw their ranks growing from these people who had previously perhaps been Democrats or perhaps been uninvolved in politics, and they thought they could be used, that they could be manipulated to achieve the goals of the intellectuals, of the establishment, and they would be, and they wouldn't really have to give them much of anything in return. And because this is the way, for example, Republicans have dealt with the anti-abortion people. They go out and give speeches. They say, yes, you're right, we must stop all abortions. Then they basically do nothing to actually stop it. And they thought that these Tea Party people could be just as easily manipulated. But the problem is, as you say, the tail began to wag the dog, and suddenly these establishment people found themselves, in essence, out of power, because the Tea Party people had seized control of their party, and now all of a sudden they're frightened. There's a guy named Matthew Continetti who writes for a right-wing publication. You know, 4 years or 7 years ago, he wrote an entire book praising Sarah Palin. And the other day he wrote an anguished column about how could my party, the Republican Party, have sunk so low as to nominate a crazy person like Donald Trump. And all I can say is, look in the mirror, pal. You know, Sarah Palin was, you know, the beginning of the end, you know, glorifying stupidity, ignorance, attitude. And Trump is simply, you know, the epitome of that.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Bruce Bartlett, what is the party heading for? Is it heading for a crack-up, or is there a way to avoid this fissure?
Well, I think they're certainly headed for a significant defeat, and they may very well lose the House and Senate. What the Republicans will do after the election is really an enormously important question that I cannot find any Republican willing to discuss publicly, because they're afraid that they will be admitting defeat by planning anything for that defeat, you see. So but I assume that at some point it will have to happen.
And are the Tea Party wing and the traditional wing of traditional conservatives, are they incompatible? Is there any middle ground?
Well, I think pragmatism and the desire to win can bring everybody together at the end of the day. Remember, the Goldwater people in 1964 came back into the Republican fold, and they all supported Nixon in 1968 because they understood the importance of winning was more important than having ideological purity. So I think that could happen. I'm not predicting it will happen. I'm not sure what will happen.
And, of course, a few years later, after Goldwater and after that massive defeat, Ronald Reagan essentially picked up from where Goldwater left off.
That's right, and I think that that's what the Tea Party people will likely tell themselves, that let's you know, regroup and find a new leader and try to retake control of the party down the road.
Well, Bruce Bartlett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Bartlett, who's a columnist for The Fiscal Times. He also contributes a weekly post to the economics blog at The New York Times and was previously a columnist for Forbes magazine and Creative Syndicate. He served on the staffs of Congressman Ron Paul and Jack Kemp and Senator Roger Jepson, and is executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress and senior policy analyst in the Reagan White House and deputy assistant secretary of economic policy at the Treasury Department during the George H.W. Bush administration. And his latest book is Benefit and Burden. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined by Ambassador Chaz Freeman. He'll be talking about his new book, America's Continuing Misadventures in the Middle East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who is a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, and a career diplomat who was assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and served as U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during the historic U.S. mediation of Namibian independence from South Africa and Cuban troop withdrawal from Angola. And Ambassador Freeman worked as Deputy Chief of Mission and Chargé d'Affaires in the American embassies in both Bangkok and Beijing and was Director of Chinese Affairs at the U.S. State Department from 1979 to 1981 and was the principal American interpreter during President Nixon's groundbreaking visit to China in 1972. His latest book is America's Continuing Misadventures in the Middle East, and he has an article at the National Interest, What America Keeps Getting Wrong in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Chas Freeman.
Glad to be back with you, Ian.
And I should add to that that President Obama, back in 2008, nominated you to be his head of the National Intelligence Office, in effect in charge of the intelligence flow to the president, and you were filibustered against, I guess. Is that the way to put it?
Well, I think I was mugged by the Israel lobby.
There you go.
Which is probably a kindness in the sense that I didn't really want the job. I'd already given 30 years to the public service and was happily pursuing my own interests. And also, frankly, the Obama administration, which I, like many, had hoped would do a fundamental review of U.S. Policies, turned out in many respects to provide a continuity with the George W. Bush administration. And I think I would have been very unhappy working in it.
And is that to suggest that the successor to Obama, which is likely to be Hillary Clinton, would, in your opinion, continue that same policy?
I'm very concerned that that would be the case. It doesn't seem that she's ever seen a quagmire she didn't wish to dive into.
So let's go through your article, both at the National Interest. You've been giving some talks, and of course, all of this is in your latest book, America's Continuing Misadventures in the Middle East. We could, of course, talk about, as you say, the imbecilities of our interminably farcical election season, but let's talk about the blunders that you've written here. I believe there's a total of 7, maybe more.
Well, I think there were 8, actually.
8, okay, yeah, you're right.
I mean, but, you know, it's not a complete list, unfortunately.
No. I'm just wondering how to facilitate this. Maybe I should just quickly go through the list, and then you can pick whichever one. Blunder number one was the failure to translate our military triumph over Saddam's Iraq in 1991 into peace with Baghdad. Blunder number two was the sudden abandonment of the 1993 strategy of maintaining peace in the Persian Gulf through a balance of power known as dual containment. Blunder number three was the unthinking transformation in December 2001 of what has been a punitive expedition to Afghanistan into a long-term pacification campaign that soon became a NATO operation. Blunder number four was the inauguration in February of 2002 in Afghanistan of a campaign using missiles fired from drones to assassinate presumed opponents. This turn towards robotic warfare has evolved into a program of serial massacres from the air. Blunder number five was the rearrangement of the region in going into Iraq, which has given strategic disadvantage to U.S. partners like Israel and Saudi Arabia and showed the United States to be militarily mighty but geopolitically naive and strategically incompetent. Blunder number six has been to confuse the motives of terrorism and with religious rationalizations its perpetrators concoct to justify their immorality. And blunder number seven is after the Yom Kippur War, we committed to providing Israel with a qualitative military edge, which has deprived Israel of any incentive to seek security through non-military means. And finally, blunder number eight has been basing U.S. policies towards Middle East on deductive reasoning grounded in ideological fantasies and politically convenient narratives rather than on inductive reasoning and reality-based analysis. So let's begin with that overall idea that we've been dealing with the Middle East as we prefer to imagine it rather than as it actually is.
Well, I think that has been the case, and it is compounded by a strange aspect of our strategic political culture at present. We do things without ever asking, and then what? So very often we end up like the dog that's caught the car, not knowing quite why we did all that and what to do with what we've accomplished. And we have a habit, since we don't seem to come up with firm objectives for the use of force, we have a habit of, in effect, moving the goalpost constantly. That was the case in Afghanistan. A very successful limited use of force with basically some CIA and special forces people on the ground, air combat controllers guiding airstrikes, tipped the balance against the Taliban and enabled us essentially within 6 weeks to accomplish our original purposes, which of course we've all forgotten now, but which were essentially to dismember the Al-Qaeda perpetrators of 9/11 and kill or capture them. And second, to punish their hosts in Afghanistan in such a way that they would never again offer safe haven to such a group. And this was essentially accomplished. And then with no public discussion at all, our operation morphed into a general campaign of pacification of Afghanistan, which continues to this day, and which we're clearly failing to achieve. I mean, we've made Afghanistan safe for poppy cultivation, if that's an objective of the United States. We haven't made it safe for feminist values, and it's not, in most respects, a democracy. In fact, it doesn't even have a government whose writ runs very far outside Kabul. So there's a pattern here of the use of force for what appears to be, in retrospect, almost feel-good purposes rather than any real objective that is feasible. So it's quite a pattern, and it's had huge effects, of course. When we began all this, the problem of Islamist extremist terrorism with global reach was a very limited phenomenon. It was present in Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan. And now we have it metastasized, in part as a result of drone warfare, all the way from Pakistan to Mali and other places in Northwest Africa. Many failed states. We're at war all over the place, in Yemen, with the Saudis, in Syria, in Libya, which we mistakenly took down without considering what would follow Muammar Gaddafi. So it's been a pattern that very depressingly has been one in which we don't seem to learn anything from our errors and keep committing the same mistakes.
So in terms of what you're suggesting, in terms of how to get out of this serial quagmire in the Middle East, is that we need to harness our military capabilities to diplomacy rather than the other way around. Let's start with the last point you made about, in effect, about takfir, about the idea that within Islam there's an exhortation and a license, if you will, to kill infidels in the name of Islam. And that has spread all around, as you mentioned, all the way from Boko Haram up to Brussels in Europe, and much of the return address appears to be the Saudi Wahhabi sect, and you're a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. How could you and how would you be able to organize a regime within the Middle East, to within Islam itself, to ban and eradicate takfir?
Well, I think takfir is very much a deviation within Islam. It's not accepted in Saudi Arabia by the so-called Wahhabi tendency there, and it's certainly condemned elsewhere. Islam is at root a very tolerant religion. In fact, the Quran enjoins that there should be no compulsion in religion. And it certainly does not, in any respect, justify or excuse murder of non-believers. That is very much a deviation. I think the key to addressing it on a broader stage is to recognize that only those who have a religious faith that is recognized as genuine by the deviants can really refute them. And in Saudi Arabia itself, there's been an extremely successful campaign spearheaded by the Crown Prince at present, Mohammed bin Nayef, who came up with a three-tier approach to handling the issue of terrorism. Tier one, which is totally missing from our approach, is an effort to invalidate the religious theology and the justifications for terrorist violence. And it's been a major political educational campaign in Saudi Arabia and in the mosques. And the result is that the popularity of the sort of version of almost a lampoon of Islam that ISIL, ISIS, or Daesh, or Al-Qaeda profess is now essentially discredited in Saudi Arabia in almost all quarters. The second tier was to identify those who appeared to be traveling in the direction of becoming terrorists, sympathizing, being recruited, moving toward volunteering for terrorism, the sort of lone wolf stuff that we have seen in the United States most recently in Orlando, or that we saw in San Bernardino. And taking these people into custody and subjecting them to a reform process in which, again, religious instruction plays a major role, as does pressure from families and friends and from the tribal leaders. The net effect of this, however, is to deprogram people and convince them that far from going to heaven if they carry out the acts they propose to carry out, they will end up in hell. And the third tier, which is the only one we know about in our practice, is to kill anybody who takes up the gun or starts building a bomb if we can catch them before they blow it up. So the question really is, how do you take this very effective approach, which has been applied in Saudi Arabia, and put it over the borders into the rest of the Middle East? How do you build a coalition that can do the same things in some of the agonized societies that are now in the Levant, Iraq or Syria, or Libya, now that it's been destabilized, or, as you mentioned, in Nigeria and other places, where this deviant form of Islam has taken hold? So I think that's the key, and I'll stop there.
Well, it would seem, though, that the Crown Prince that you mentioned, Mohammed Nayef, has he been somewhat marginalized by the Deputy Crown Prince, the son of King Salman, who just visited the White House, and reports from the White House indicate that the U.S. is concerned they have to back his reforms, even though some think he was a little reckless in getting into Yemen, because they're afraid the place could come apart?
Well, I think Mohammed bin Nayef's brief has remained largely in the counterterrorism internal security area. There are rumors now that he's ill. I don't know whether those are correct or not. So it's very clear that the deputy crown prince, the favored son of King Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, now has a much broader range of authorities and a larger role in Saudi foreign and domestic policy than the Crown Prince does. So that's correct. I don't think there's any great reason to expect Saudi Arabia to fall apart. It's been the case historically that many, many people, for one reason or another, have anticipated it doing that, but it's instead it's been boringly stable for 70 years, and I don't see any reason to doubt that that will continue to be the case. But I want to go back, if I might, to the earlier question. One of the big problems we have in dealing with Islamist terrorism is that we mistake the rationalization for the terrorism, which is the religious element, for the motivation, which is not religious. There are political grievances. There are impulses to revenge for perceived humiliations and indignities that are causing people to seek revenge or to take out their anger with violent acts. And the role of the theology of this strange, deviant, perverted version of Islam really is to enable those who are carrying out these acts of violence to feel part of something larger than themselves. So you see this Omar Mateen in Orlando pledging allegiance simultaneously within minutes of each other to both the Islamic State and to its mortal enemy, Hezbollah. This is somebody who is disturbed, who is looking for validation through association with a wider cause. So the Islamic element is a very important one in terms of sustaining the cohesion of movements like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, or Hezbollah for that matter. But it is not the motivator for the crimes that its adherents commit. And we really have to address the political issues that underlie their anger if we're going to deal with this. And in Europe, and increasingly, unfortunately, in the United States, Islamophobia is creating resentments and alienation that drive people in the direction of association with this particular Salafi jihadi perversion of Islam.
So when you listed the efforts that the Saudis have made under the Crown Prince Nayef to deal with this Salafist radicalism, the takfir within their own country, could you extend that out to the United States in the sense that in this so-called war on terror, which mercifully is not, I believe they've ended that category, but nevertheless, in the context of Orlando, there is this sense that in many ways, when Hillary Clinton and others talk about we've got to deal with the lone wolves, at the end of the day, it would seem that American Muslims are the front line here, and that the last thing in the world you want to do is alienate the Muslim community, because they're our best hope to dissuade young Muslims who may take this deviant path, rather than, you know, victimize them and stigmatize them like Donald Trump is doing.
Well, I think you're exactly right. Islamophobia is the greatest recruiter for Islamist extremism, and if we take law-abiding, decent citizens and treat them with disrespect and disdain and with prejudice, if we make them feel that they're under siege, then they will naturally react. And that is exactly what we don't want to do. And I think broadly speaking, whether it's domestically in the United States or abroad, we are not going to be able to cope with defeat or even seriously set back this set of deviant Muslims if we don't have an alliance with mainstream conservative Muslims. And so we should be trying to find ways to make common cause with the parents of people who are tempted in the wrong direction, with the Muslim community generally in the United States, and certainly with those in the Middle East, and who are deeply disturbed. And frankly, they are the first victims of this particular kind of of Islamist violence long before we are.
And of course, the sore that we're dealing with in at the moment is both Iraq, where Fallujah has been taken, but it's turned into a massive humanitarian catastrophe, and every day that goes by, more and more agony is besets that country. And the extent to which we're responsible for it, I think, is somewhat glossed over. But Syria seems to be the focus now, and now you have 51 U.S. diplomats through the back channel that was set up during the Vietnam War for dissent, very unhappy with President Obama's Syria policy. The Secretary of State, Kerry, almost seems to somewhat sympathize with the dissidents. But what would your, if you were in the State Department, where would you stand on this idea that Russia's adding salt in the wound by humiliating the U.S. by bombing its proxies down on the border with Jordan, and then when the F-18s took off to chase the Russian planes away, when they were refueling, the Russians came back and bombed them again, and there could have been American advisors there. So it was something that's really got at least our diplomats, and I imagine by extension our military, chafing at the bit. So what would your advice be?
Well, I think I'd start by noting that, generally speaking, civilians are much more bloodthirsty than the military. The military have to lay their lives on the line in military campaigns. The civilians don't. But beyond that, the military understand far better than the civilians generally the limitations of the use of force and the requirement of it for it to be linked to some political purpose. In the case of these 51 so-called diplomats, we don't know who they are. They could well be, in large measure, political appointees of one sort or another. Clearly, as you said, Secretary Kerry has sympathized with the view that they expressed. In fact, there are some suspicions that he may have encouraged the leak of this internal dissent, which I think if he did was a mistake, because I think it's important for people to be able to have the opportunity inside an organization, inside the government, to express dissident views, and that can't occur if those views promptly leak and embarrass the administration and politicize the whole thing. But that aside, my main objection to what they're advocating is that it's more of the same. It has no apparent link to any feasible political purpose. It seems to assume, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that regime removal inevitably results in an improvement of the regime, and we should know better than that, whether from the assassination of Ngo Tin Diem in Vietnam or Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, or the invasion of Iraq, or whatever. Anyway, there's no evidence to sustain that that hope. It is an evasion of their responsibility, if they are diplomats, to formulate and pursue diplomatic solutions. So frankly, I'm not very impressed by that on any level, except that it does show the extent to which the politicization of institutions like the Department of State has proceeded, and how much they are part of the Washington bubble.
But in the broader sense, what's the explanation for why in Syria the Russians, the Iranians, and the Assad regime have always known what they wanted? The U.S. and its allies have known what they don't want, but they've never been able to figure out what they want. There's always been a deficit there in strategic thinking, hasn't there?
Well put. And in fact, in some respects, although Mr. Putin is a problem in many ways, he has shown in Syria a very effective use of limited force for a diplomatic set of political purposes. He hasn't moved the goalposts. He's cut back when he's achieved the milestones he set out to do. With really just a couple of squadrons from his Air Force and some special operations forces. He has reinvigorated the regime, restored its morale, put it back on the offensive. He's forced the United States to join a much more credible peace process in Syria than we had, and one in which regime removal is no longer a given. And we've had to recognize both Russia and Iran as participants in that process. He's partly contained the threat that the Islamic State, which is full of Chechens from Russia, poses to Russian internal security. And he's put his hand on the tap for the massive flows of refugees from Syria who are destabilizing Europe. So he's reminded Europe that Europe has to deal with Russia as a great power, even if it's not a global power. And finally, he's showed the Muslim world, the Arab world, people in the region, that he sticks by his protégés, unlike the United States, which was almost gleeful in watching Hosni Mubarak toppled from power in Egypt. So that's not bad for a really rather minor investment of the use of force. The man knew what he was doing when he put that force in there, and he's accomplished a fair amount of it. And that should be a lesson to us. We shouldn't be using force except when it can plausibly yield some advantageous set of political and other results. That's not been our practice. We've seen the use of force almost as an end in itself.
Just in the last minute, Ambassador Freeman, in your article at the National Interest, you say Israel is strangling Gaza while swallowing the rest of Palestine alive, and Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain are in a near state of war with Iran. Hillary Clinton just the other day castigated the Saudis and said the Saudis and the Qataris and others should stop their citizens from sending money to Daesh. Just in the last minute, are you suggesting that more agony is to come in the Middle East? We've talked about how you may be able to tamp things down, but just on that last note.
Well, I'm afraid that's likely to be the case. I mean, if you do more of the same, you'll get more of the same. We don't have, you know, Mr. Trump is completely incoherent on the subject of what to do, so we don't know what he would do if he's elected. Maybe he'd do something different and we'd get a different result, but we don't know that. Mrs. Clinton is arguing for more of the same. Einstein was right. If you do more of the same, you shouldn't expect to get different results. So I'm afraid, yes. Some years ago, I wrote a book called America's Misadventures in the Middle East. 5 years later, I had to write another one, America's Continuing Misadventures in the Middle East. And the way we're going, there may well yet be a sequel in the same series.
Well, Ambassador Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Chas Freeman, who's a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs and a career diplomat who was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and served as U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. His latest book is America's Continuing Misadventures in the Middle East, and he has an article at the National Interest, What America Keeps Getting Wrong in the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.